Hi, everybody. This is Brett, and welcome back to School Sucks. Today is February 19th, and while we're in between episodes 2 and 3 in our science series, I had something I wanted to share with you. I actually have quite a few things that I want to share with you. I'm developing a bit of a backlog here. This is one of them. Last week, I had the privilege of appearing on the one and only libertarian podcast in the country of Scotland. It's called the Greening Out Podcast, and I want to say a huge thanks to Dan and Katie Green for having me on. If you're interested in history and you're fairly new to the study, I would say this would be a good optional show for you. We talk a little bit about my school experience, but I'm going to skip over that because you've heard that stuff before. We talk about history through the government schools. We talk about history through film. And we also talk about how mainstream media in the present will distort understandings of the past in the future. So look for another science show coming this weekend sometime. And I just want to say I really appreciate everyone's participation in our Facebook group. It looks like there's a great conversation going on there about the last show. I'm going to try and get caught up on reading all of it today. And if you listen to a show and something upsets you or it gets you thinking or you have some valuable input, please go to schoolsucksproject.com and leave a comment on the actual show. That way it is permanently tied to that episode. The whole Facebook setup just seems a little more ephemeral to me. You know, the most popular threads are always at the top. So again, thanks to everybody who's participating in that conversation. And that will probably help determine the future direction of that series, which seems to be expanding quite nicely. And I'm really excited about it. And if you are interested in a quick and easy and free way to help the School Sucks Project, please consider going to iTunes and leaving a review for us. It's really easy, only takes a minute. You can do it in your pajamas, and it really helps. So when a show has a lot of reviews on iTunes, especially if a bunch of reviews come in close proximity to each other, it makes us more visible. And I'm not fishing for good reviews. You can go there and write something like, "This podcaster's premise is that taxes are morally wrong and tyrannical. Anything that comes from those taxes is also morally wrong and tyrannical. As a result, public schools should be destroyed since they are funded by taxes. Give me a break. As a democracy, heck, as a species, we've decided that we're all better off when we don't have uneducated people making important decisions. I generally admire the gumption of libertarianism, but it's this type of caustic rhetoric that can really damage the lives of ordinary people if the folks in power buy into it. You should not be indignant because we have compulsory education. Reform the system is needed, but don't advocate destroying it." Actually, wait, somebody already wrote that review. So write your own, but be as hostile as you like. Like I said, it's not about fishing for positive reviews. It's just about getting more reviews up there on iTunes. The more visible on iTunes we become, the more likely it is that new listeners will be attracted to the show. The more listeners that are attracted to the show, the more likely that some of them will support the show. The more people support the show, the bigger projects we can tackle. And before you know it, we are launching our own telescope into deep space to scout for planets and then terraform them as needed to build our own schools out of the reach of the United States government that wants us to pay taxes which are morally wrong and tyrannical. And that's how it works. So anyway, I hope you enjoy this episode of Greening Out. I hope everyone had a wonderful Valentine's Day. Here's a smooch from me, and here we go.
You're listening to the Greening Out podcast. This show contains profanity, hate for the state, and themes of a libertarian nature. If you are easily offended, please listen to something else. For more, visit greeningoutpodcast.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Katie Green.
Hi, I'm Dan Green. Welcome back to the Greening Out podcast.
Today we are joined by Brett Vinot from the School Sucks Project.
Brett, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
So, Brett, for any of our listeners who may not already know, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and about the School Sucks project as well?
Yeah, for many, many years,
I worked in what I called at the time education.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on is because I know that you've done a lot of shows and you've talked about history and things, and we've done quite a few shows lately, and we've discussed historical events and, you know, people, and it kind of got the two of us thinking about history in general and how like there's totally different narratives and different approaches to history.
Everything's sort of biased, and things can be told inaccurately for probably monetary reasons, maybe.
We'll get there.
We'll get there. I'm skipping about 10 steps ahead.
But if we're starting, I think when I first started looking at different types of like sort of historical research and narratives and things, I came across this thing called the Great Man Theory. So, Brett, do you want to explain to anyone who doesn't know what the Great Man Theory is?
Yeah, the Great Man Theory, and the word great doesn't mean, you know, swell
oh,
guy.
Great. Yeah. You know, yeah.
It means just really historically significant. And what's basically behind this theory is that individuals can be driving forces in history. Individuals themselves, almost always heads of state, can change the course of history or actually set a historical trend. So some people who often fall into the Great Man Theory of history would be Hitler, Franklin Roosevelt, Benito Mussolini, Abraham Lincoln. I don't want to make this super American-centric. I'm trying to think of you know, other examples from outside. Charlemagne, Julius Caesar, of course. So people who weren't reacting to trends and forces in their time, but actually setting the trends and being the force. So it is a little dangerous, and there might be some truth to it, right? It's one lens through which we can try to develop an accurate picture of the past, but it's also a little bit dangerous because it can lead to a kind of hero worship. That's certainly been the case here in America with figures like Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson, FDR, three of our most dangerous leaders who've been, you know, lionized. And basically, historians have built monuments to them, figuratively, of course. But there's not much question, certainly in our public schools, about the heroism of those people.
And that is actually, I liked how I remember the series you did with Thaddeus Russell when you were talking. You mentioned FDR and how it was funny how you showed how a lot of the National Socialists thought that the New Deal was great. Quite funny, quite weird. But so talking about this Great Man Theory, I noticed that from my reading of it, one of the sort of main sort of opponents of this was Herbert Spencer. And he, from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but from it seems to me from what he was saying was that he felt it was more that the men were shaped by the society and the culture around them rather than them setting the trends themselves. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And that's actually the trends and forces theory of history, right? Where there is a kind of social or cultural momentum that individuals have to respond to. And if they respond in an appropriate or alarmingly inappropriate, you know, way, maybe they then can, we can switch, I should say, to the Great Man Theory, right? If somebody sees where they are in the current and, you know, does something significant or drastic, yes, then maybe as far as historical impact is concerned, they are a great man. And then we bring out that lens to maybe look a little more closely at them. But the way I've described it before is, you know, you think about the past, and obviously the further back in the past you go, the more difficult this gets. But like you think about the past, like filming a scene in a movie, and you need a variety of lights and angles and, and lenses to try and capture the closest thing you can to the truth, to what actually happened, you know. So one of the things that I really recommend while we're speaking about these historical lenses is that before anybody engages in a deep study of history, and of course, history. That can mean so many things, you know, all different kinds of history. I would recommend having a basic understanding of historiography, which is essentially the methodology that historians use and how history basically developed as a discipline, and what the attitude was surrounding maybe the historical works on a particular subject. Right. Now, let's go back to Franklin Roosevelt, which is an interesting one. One of the reasons why the National Socialists in Germany, the Nazis, that not only liked the New Deal, but Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi minister of propaganda, was like really impressed with FDR's management of the public in that he basically invented the legend of himself in real time through largely manipulation of the press, which is a huge danger. If you can manipulate the press in the present, obviously that's going to determine what the future is going to think and quote unquote know about you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you think then, if we're looking at history, you know, you say we bring in this lens and that lens. Do you think that it's more like we have to not just go with sort of one theory, we have to sort of take little bits from different sort
of
theories?
You have to understand the argument and the counter-argument.
And put it all together,
that,
yeah.
That
almost
kind of theory.
More like a mosaic or something, using these different kinds of methods.
Yeah, and historians actually do have ways of trying to bring many things in to try and develop a coherent picture of what's going on. Mm-hmm. So there's procedures for reconciling contradictory sources, procedures for determining reliability, examining eyewitness evidence and oral traditions. And there is a methodology to history. And unfortunately, one of the things that I've touched on my show is it's not taught in school. History is not taught as a deliberative process mm-hmm. with controversy. It's taught the same way that math or science are taught yeah. in school. But it's yeah. final, it's been decided. And if you read this book or you listen to this teacher, you can know what happened to.
Yeah, Dan and I recently spoke in one of our shows, I can't remember which one exactly, but we're talking about historical inaccuracies, and we're talking about history class in our school. Dan and I went to school together, and we were taught about World War II. Hitler was the bad guy, mm-hmm. and we were the good guys, and that was the gist of it. But we were never taught anything about World War I, and the because Dan, this was quite recently, you and I were talking about this.
Yeah, you can't understand World War II without World War I, and yeah. obviously there was things left out, like, you know, the Dresden firebombing, which was surely a war crime by anyone's standards, by, you know, mm-hmm. what we call the Allied side.
Yeah.
Do you find it's kind of similar, like in the US, the way they teach World War II like that?
Yeah, it seems like it just started.
Happened. Hitler woke up one day and went, you know what? I'm going to invade them. Screw
yeah.
it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and the same thing happened. Once you get away with that, you know, one of the notes that you sent me was talking about the dangers of not understanding history, right? Mm-hmm. And that's perfectly relevant here, because if you get away with that in the presentation of World War II in textbooks, well, 55, 60 years later in this country, 9/11 happens, and mm-hmm. the timeline starts on mm-hmm. September 11th, mm-hmm. 2001. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't start maybe where it should. You know, the connection between World War II and 9/11 is those timelines should both probably start sometime in the 1910s, you yeah. know. But the World War II timeline starts in 1939 when Hitler invades mm-hmm. Poland, and then the U.S. part where the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor, and the 9/11 timeline starts on 9/11. So you're missing a historical context there that obviously, and that's all intentional. If people don't have that context, they're not going to understand the event. They're going to be empty vessels for what politicians and mainstream media want to tell them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know if you ever saw, there was a series, a three-part series in the BBC by, Adam Curtis.
It was Adam Curtis,
The
yes.
Power of Nightmares. And
that went way back.
Yeah, what they did was they took the roots of the sort of radical Islamist movement and the neoconservative movement, and they took all that back to when they started in like the 40s.
It's quite fascinating, actually. I will, of course, link it up at the bottom of the show.
The Power of Nightmares is one of the best documentaries that I've ever seen. Mm. And I think Adam Curtis is a spectacular filmmaker. Just how he even, like, if he can't get, you know, some of the things that he's talking about, he goes so into depth that obviously there's no real footage of Saeed Kutep, the ideological mind behind radical Islam, right? Mm-hmm. So he uses all this clever, like, B-reel stock footage. And it's just really, really amazing movies. And I mean, I'm from here and I don't know how the politics of entertainment work there, but I remember watching it. I'm like, how did this wind up on what is essentially state television?
Yeah,
It's incredibly interesting. Dan and I were talking about how the fact it's the BBC, which is wrapped up in controversy a lot of the time recently, and Dan and I were wondering how this does end up getting out there. But
and he's made a new one called Bitter Lake.
It's really good.
It's incredible. That was just recently on the BBC, and there he examines the sort of the roots of the
the apathetic culture.
Yeah, and he goes back to like the deals between Saudi Arabia and the UK and the US, you know, that have led to, you know, obviously now why the Saudis get support.
A lot of people don't know this too. I mean, you talk to general public, and I'm not saying anything bad about people, because I didn't know about a lot of this stuff until recently. I will be incredibly honest with you.
But then we can tie it. I was just thinking there, we can tie this into what we're talking about, as in not understanding history can be dangerous.
This is what it is, because then you're living
don't realise, for example, that the Mujahideen were funded, you know, by the, you know, the British and the US to fight the Soviets, and that's having a real impact now.
Yeah.
And similarly, some people think, oh, well, Afghanistan women are treated terribly, so that's why we are going over there to bring them democracy, and we're going to make things better for them. But they never mention Saudi Arabia, where conditions are every bit as bad, if not worse, for women.
Recently, a man was given a sentence of, 5,000 lashings or something, because he spoke out against the state.
Yeah,
it was awful.
Yeah,
awful.
And this misunderstanding's having real consequences now, because there's, you know, it seems like there's constant war there. And then it gets people kind of hyped up and sort of supporting that war. Would you agree?
Well, that's the point, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with what both of you are saying. I mean, the thing, though, is if this understanding is available, you can't divide into good and evil. Mm-hmm. Right. What we were told about 9/11, it distills down to, and just as far as like dumbing down the public and robbing people of an opportunity to really understand what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. We were told that these people live in caves and they hate us
because of our freedom.
Yeah, like our free and capricious lifestyles and our decadent. I mean, they live in caves and they resent us for our lives. That was the plot of a Looney Tunes cartoon from like the 60s called The Roadrunner. You know, people just were like, oh yeah, okay, I understand that. I remember watching The Roadrunner when I grew up, and we're the Roadrunner and they're the coyote. I see. So Adam Curtis did a great service to, I mean, Adam Curtis didn't go into the geopolitical, you know, going all the way back to World War One. Of course, he starts with the ideological developments, which was the Chicago University guy, Lee Strauss, in the United States, and Saeed Kutep, the Egyptian, in the Middle East. And he kind of parallels both of the ideological developments. And it's beautiful. Now, Adam Curtis has, you know, a lot of biases. He's very liberal. He somehow manages to make a hero out of Bill Clinton of the movie. But it is a brilliant documentary. And when I first saw it, I think probably in 2005, it was life changing for me. Because I was very confused. I was getting sucked into programs like Coast to Coast Radio and Alex Jones. And not that those things don't have, you know, merits on their own for certain things, but they're not vehicles for developing a broad and calm understanding of the present world or the past world. So things are dumbed down to be able to pump fear into people. And that's just a circle. The more fear, the less understanding. The less understanding, the more fear. And, you know, whatever narratives powerful people want to push, they can do, because, you know, people are, just like I said before, these empty vessels who because they are so fearful, just tell us something, tell us information, don't leave us in the dark. And and they're very uncritical about what they'll accept.
Yeah, absolutely. And we find that the politics of fear has just been... I keep
telling Dan that I'm waiting for the day when they say we need to have CCTV in our homes if we have children, just in case we're raging paedophiles or something. Mm-hmm. I'm waiting for it. I'm just waiting for that kind of legislation. In Scotland, we already have the named persons thing coming into power now. This is when every child in Scotland... Yeah. I don't really want to misword
this. They'll have to have basically a state representative for every child. So this kind of bizarre stuff is already
going
on. But I do see what you mean about
I went off topic.
No,
we're going to go way off topic a lot of the time, probably. Okay. But I know what you mean. Like, so how it makes it kind of simpler if you've got like the bad guys are them and the good guys are us. And it seems like it's always kind of been like this way. And that's... Like it's been, it's, it seems like it's, I
history
kind of think
keeps
it's divide and rule.
Itself,
yeah.
Yeah.
And was there not some, was there not a theory attributed to, now I might get this wrong, but do you know why I remember this? I remember Ian Curtis from Joy Division talking about it. And it was to do with like a theory that, for example, history always repeats itself. Mm. So for example, the Romans and stuff like that were eventually the Nazis, you know, like these people keep coming back and coming back and coming back.
And that guy, you know, killed himself, so he was pretty dark.
Yeah, as my friend Richard Grove says, you know, history might not repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes. You know, like you'll see a lot of very similar things, and you can make a lot of connections. I made an 8-minute video years ago comparing the modern U.S. to Nazi Germany. Yeah. A lot of negative YouTube comments about that.
I bet you got a lot of love for that, Brett.
Yeah, so I really dove into it and wound up producing about 5 hours of audio explaining this 8-minute video. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was a great learning experience for me, but it was also very, very startling because I started finding all of these connections that I didn't even know were there. I mean, mm-hmm. I had originally thought that it was as simple as having the same types of top-down nationalistic school systems, you know, that basically encourage obedience mm-hmm. and conformity and loyalty to the state that had produced these similar outcomes in these two places. But there were, you know, parallel economic components. There were parallel social and philosophical components. I'm sure we could find many examples between, you know, the current U.S. People have compared it to Rome. It's a little harder to do because it was so long ago. There's so many mm-hmm. variables to consider. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would say there is a rhyming to history because people don't learn from it. But the other thing, too, is that there's a momentum. Like, let me just think about U.S. history, for example. So we have the story about Lincoln, right? What is the ultimate lesson that, oh, look at the problems violence can solve, right? Look at the problems the state can solve. So we go forward 50, 60 years and we have Wilson, you know, and it's like, oh, well, since we've already learned that violence can solve problems, you know, or state threats of violence can already solve problems, the stage is set for Wilson. We go forward, gosh, just like 12 years. We've already learned from Lincoln and Wilson that the state can solve problems using violence. Here's FDR, you know, and then that continues with Johnson, Bush, Obama. Mm-hmm. So when people didn't learn the truth or a more accurate version of the time of Lincoln, the time of Wilson, the time of FDR, it's set a very dangerous precedent for what people believe government power is capable of, right? Mm-hmm. So the more we fail to learn about the present in the present, the more dangerous a mainstream, especially public school study of history becomes mm-hmm. for what it means for the future.
Mm-hmm. And did you not do a thing as well before explaining how basically the planks of the Communist Manifesto had been implemented in America?
Oh, I'm one of maybe like 1,000 people. Yeah, I think we did try to line that up at one point on the show, and I would say like 7 or 8 of them are pretty consistent with what Marx and Engels wrote. 7 of 8 things that Marx and Engels wrote are consistent with what's going on here, I should say.
Yeah, that's quite funny when you think of it that way. But Also, something I've thought about history is it's kind of, there's almost like a what we're allowed to know sort of thing. I mean, we did a show a while ago about the Norwegian black metal music scene and how there was all this philosophy behind it, because a lot of the people in these bands were sort of angry about, you know, the perceived sort of Christianization of Europe and how a lot of the texts of like pre-Christian European civilization, a lot of them were burned or Christianized. So it seems that we can trace this kind of thing of what we're allowed to know right back. And that has a lot of kind of, we see that kind of coming up all the time. You always hear about these, and how many times have you heard about these anomalous things that have been found and then suddenly the Smithsonian put it in a room and then we lost it, you know?
Yeah.
And even if we talk about modern people who have, say, questioned the Holocaust. I'm not a Holocaust denier, but I think when you're putting people in prison for questioning something that happened historically, something is badly, badly wrong.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's very dangerous.
Yeah, and it always seems like, do you ever find that? So it's like, it's what we're allowed to know, and it always seems like the whatever government, whoever's in charge, just decides what's permitted for us to know and what isn't.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, I think that's really done through the media. It's done through the very political textbook adoption processes. I mean, sometimes it's not so much a central conspiracy as just like, you know, there's a Texas for those, you know, for maybe the younger people overseas, you know, one of our states, Texas, has a textbook adoption committee for the schools, and they have a certain ideology that they want to push, and they have, you know, certain things that they want to avoid. You know, they don't want the federal government coming in and telling them they have to talk about, you know, gay marriage or something that people by and large on the textbook committee anyway disagree with. So they can block that. And there's actually been examples in the not too distant past where textbook companies like McGraw-Hill and Houghton Mifflin wrote special versions of their American history textbooks for certain states to guarantee that those books would get adopted in those states. So they basically had to change or take things out, I'm guessing. I'm guessing they had to take a lot more things out than they did to have to add in to like bolster the history and majesty of Texas or whatever state that we're talking about. So it can happen on a small level. I think it can happen on a large level, obviously, with this new federal education initiative that we have here, Common Core. The history curriculum is being rewritten. The English curriculum, which is obviously another way to get some historical insights. A lot of the great books that have strangely been available to adolescents in the schools for a long time are disappearing in favor of like EPA manuals that they're now going to read, Environmental Protection Agency documents that they read instead of, you know, like Catcher in the Rye or something like that. But I think a big part of that, as George Orwell discussed in 1984, was controlling the present. And that's what I talked about with FDR. The more you control the present, the less you have to worry about the future as far as what people will know.
Yeah. And actually, surprisingly, we were allowed to, we read 1984 when I was in school. I don't know if that still happens, but like we read Animal Farm as well. So I don't know what kind of place we were in.
they're starting to pull them now. Obviously, those books were very popular in school. I'm in schools here, I'm guessing in the 60s and the 70s, because 1984 appeared to be about a communist dystopia. It probably wasn't until the 1990s where people started drawing parallels between 1984 and the United States. A lot of people started to get cold on Orwell when the Soviet Union collapsed, and there was this kind of vacuum, you know, this comparison vacuum, like, okay, well, what is 1984 about now? Because it wasn't really that, you know, that wasn't an all-powerful government. It was a house of cards. So what is 1984 about? And when that parallel started to happen, it seemed, I'm not saying it was, you know, a conspiracy, but it seemed like people became more cautious about handing 1984 and Animal Farm and even Huxley's Brave New World to young people in the last 15 or 20 years.
It's funny because Katie and I were talking about things like this as well, and I was saying if I was running a school and I was the state, I would want them only to believe what I would want to control the narrative, because we did a show about the anarchist Emma Goldman, and Katie was talking about how she's looked through a lot of books about, like, say, feminism and things like that, and a lot of the time Emma Goldman's just a footnote in favour
of
these.
She's actually more of a footnote in the sense of that they just say she sort of fought for the sexual liberation of women. That's the only bit that they really say.
And then because she didn't want, she looked at the suffrage movement as being kind of pointless because in her mind it was the state that was the problem, and it doesn't matter the genitalia of who's in power, but it's just...
You're not going to find out about that in most... I've got a few books about feminism that just... And they're written by all different people, but they all have the same sort of leftist narrative. And Emma Goldman's not really mentioned at all.
Yeah,
but it's interesting.
It's more
that,
like the people who are in favour of the state of get course. Much more airtime, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, they were involved in more...
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just a side note. that's just an example of things that you don't find out unless you actually go actively looking for it.
Yeah, because you can't be, if you're the state, you're not going to be able to start teaching people about anarchists, aside from the fact that you're going to say they're crazy.
Yeah, that's the only kind of...
See, if we're talking about crazy sort of ideologies,
on that note.
Wait here this for a course. When I was in school, we went to Catholic school and we had to do like a religious education class, like, sort of compulsory, but then you could take it at a higher level when you got, you know, to a certain age. You got to fifth year, we call it. You got to take it as philosophy if you wanted to. So I took it as philosophy, and it was split into two classes with two teachers. And now they're billing this as a philosophy class. One class was about Catholic theology, and the other class was about Marxism.
Interesting.
Is that not a bizarre sort of weird combination?
That is a bizarre weird combination. I don't even, just hearing this for the first time, I'm not sure how
that makes any sense.
The two were connected. Was there an attempt to connect the two, or
no? It was like two separate
contrast.
No, it was just two separate units, two separate classes, but it was the one class, but we were supposed to have, say, maybe four periods a week. So two classes were in Marxism and two were in Catholic theology. It's really strange to
bill
that as philosophy.
They want you to obey big time because, you know, Catholic guilt, you know, mixed with Marxism equals
obedient
people.
I just love telling people that because they kind of go, what the fuck was that? But what we're going to do as well, we're going to kind of segue into talking about films because we did a show. I keep saying it's like everything I do is we did too many shows on Braveheart. How that was largely
inaccurate.
Yeah, largely inaccurate. And then I suppose you're over there in the US, so the sort of parallel to Braveheart in the US would be, I suppose, The Patriot starring Mel Gibson, which was also wildly inaccurate. Are you familiar with the film?
Yeah, Mel Gibson, the culprit in both cases.
Interesting.
Have you seen it, Brett?
The Patriot, I've seen parts of it, and I haven't seen Braveheart in, I guess, almost 20 years now.
Yeah. I don't want to see it again.
Yeah, I mean, Braveheart takes place, what, like 700 years ago? So it's going to be more difficult to do an accurate historical presentation than something that takes place less than 250 years ago. Mm-hmm. 250 years ago. I think there's some general considerations for history on film that are worth discussing. I mean, I'm guessing there were probably a lot of small inaccuracies in Braveheart, or especially with the presentation of William Wallace, because I'm guessing at least in Scotland, because of what he did, he's become kind of a legendary figure. So before you know it, he has he's 7 feet tall. He's got a giant blue ox, you know, those kinds of things. He freed the slaves. They're just picking some stories we hear about people. So the legend kind of snowballs over time. But I'm guessing there's also a lot of small historical inaccuracies just about the details of the time period. So what were some of the things that you guys discussed?
Some of the things were Prima Nocta, which was, you know, it's depicted that the Lord gets to have sex with someone's wife on the wedding night. That never happened. There was no such practice in the medieval world. A lot of the stuff about Robert the Bruce is quite inaccurate. Even the clothes they're wearing the completely wrong sort of clothes for the time period. It's even that bad. What's the thing? I had it here. There was a thing about the... It was the portrayal of the time period. They made it sound like They said we can have what we never had before, a country of our own. So it made it sound like that in their lifetime there had never uh-huh. been a Scotland of their own. But in fact, Scotland had only been invaded the year earlier by England. You know, yeah. So there's all these kinds of things.
But then that kind of brought us on to a thing, Dan, that sometimes history could be quite boring. Like, nobody wants... I think in the future, nobody's going to want to hear... They're not going to make a Hollywood film about when a bill was passed.
But see, that's what makes me think then. Am I wearing my tinfoil hat or am I not? Are people making these movies to portray a certain narrative? Or are they making these films like this just to make them more exciting?
Yeah.
What do you think?
It reminds me of this quote. There was this studio boss many years ago, Daryl Zanuck, who said there's nothing, I'm kind of paraphrasing here, there's nothing duller on the screen than being accurate. You know, so I think that speaks to what Katie was saying. And obviously they're not going to make sacrifices, I should say, in what's going to entertain the audience in favor of historical accuracy. I also think that at least in Hollywood, there's a laziness factor. I mean, they make bad TV shows into movies here. Mm-hmm. Like, I've seen trailers.
I believe you.
Yeah. And I'm saying they made a movie out of the A-Team.
And they
do it simply because the stories already exist. The characters are already fleshed out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I was talking to Dan, and I do apologize. This is quite random, but Spider-Man movie, the one with Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst, I went to the cinema to see that. I still remember that quite vividly. They've already remade that for a younger audience who don't remember the one with Tobey Maguire, but it was like 2002.
That
makes me feel pretty old, and I'm not old at all. So
yeah, that happened with Batman. Not that I minded. I thought the Batman movies were fantastic. But So, I mean, if you think about how they're just recycling and recycling and recycling, what does that mean when they come to history? You know, it's not like they're going to dig into a historical film because they want to undertake a major research project. They want to say, David McCullough wrote a book. Doris Kearns Goodwin, the ultimate, you know, president worshiper, bad president, violent president worshiper, Doris Kearns Goodwin, who wrote the book about Lincoln, the one about FDR. She wrote one about Lyndon Johnson. She's, let's just, you know, write a script out of the book. Even like filmmakers that I respect, like Steven Spielberg, transferred Doris Kearns Goodwin's lionization of Abraham Lincoln into, you know, one of the biggest movies, I think, a couple of years ago by the same name, Lincoln. Yeah. So they're not getting into this because they want to do major historical investigations. They want a story that's already written. Hey, was it also a bestseller? Awesome. We're done.
That,
you know, let's just transfer that to the screen. Let's take a book and turn it into a screenplay and we're good to go. So, you know, another problem with Hollywood and people like Lincoln and Doris Kearns Goodwin, or movies like Lincoln and people like Doris Kearns Goodwin, remind me of this balancing act that I think exists in Hollywood between loyalty to a certain left-wing ideology and giving the public what they want. Mm-hmm. You know, that Hollywood films are filled with political messages. But people are not, you know, marched into the theater and forced to watch them. They also have to consider, what does the public want to see? Mm-hmm. Is the public interested in historical accuracy? No, right? Because they, I forget who it was who said it. The filmmaker John Sayles, he made Eight Men Out, which was a film about how the Chicago White Sox threw the World Series in like the 19-teens. He said something like, you know, if that was the case, if people cared about that, then historians would be on the boards at these major studios. Mm-hmm. But they're nowhere to be found. I mean, they make historical movies sometimes without consulting historians.
I can believe it.
There's other problems, too, that wind up hurting historical accuracies of a film that I can think of. If you want to make a period piece, which is obviously almost every historical film is going to be a period piece set in a certain time and place. Mm. Well, what do you need? You need bigger budgets, you know? And when there's more funds involved, this is where studio executives and producers, people who don't know even that much about filmmaking, you know, never mind history, they're going to come into it and they're going to want to control more of it. It reminds me, like, this is somewhat related, but we were recently talking about The Godfather on my show.
Oh, yeah.
Show we did about film censorship. And I'm reading about The Godfather and Robert Evans, who's just like, you know, stereotypical Hollywood producer of the 70s wearing tinted glasses and an ascot and, you know, smoking some kind of a with maybe a cigarette holder or something. That's what I picture when I hear about Robert Evans. You know, he says to Francis Ford Coppola, who directed The Godfather, he says, you know who would be perfect for Michael Corleone? Robert Redford. He's really hot right now. Now, Robert Redford has red. These are Italians, these people. Robert Redford has red hair.
Redford.
You know.
He couldn't be any more, like, not Italian. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, and that was brought to his attention. They're like, yeah, Robert Redford might be a little waspy looking for a Sicilian. You know?
Yeah.
He's like, well, maybe they could be from, like, northern Italy or something. You gotta get Robert Redford in there. So, I mean, imagine that with historical treatments, you know, that kind of just blind meddling in the treatment of some kind of detailed historical topic. The accuracy, especially if it's controversial, especially if it contradicts the ideology that they want to push in Hollywood generally. And it's not that it's always a conscious process to push it. It's just that that's what most people in Hollywood are. They're very liberal. They're very big government. Government can solve problems, whether it's the military or Lincoln or both, you know. So there's a lot of considerations. And I think I do understand the Hollywood control, mind control, conspiracy talk and all that. But there's a lot of nuance in how history gets thrown out the window in what are supposed to be historical films.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, like I was making notes earlier and I wrote something down, but what you were just saying there about the historical inaccuracies, maybe it not being a kind of on purpose thing. It's just that there, when there's money involved for monetary purposes, things will be tarted up. If you will. So I hadn't really thought about that side of it, but I was going to ask, keeping that in mind, though, in the future, do you think it will be different? Because at the moment, the world is so technological now, so much more than it ever was. And obviously, so on that note, do you think it will be different in the future because we have all this documentation now of what's going on? I mean, obviously, Braveheart, I don't think William Wallace kept a diary of what he did every day. I know that
he didn't have a Facebook.
He didn't have a Facebook, you know. He didn't have a Twitter. And, you know, I'm just wondering how this will play out in the future.
Somebody's on Twitter as him.
But do you think it makes any difference at all? Or do you think that the powers that be, the powers that sort of control things, tinfoil hat time, do you think they will just censor it completely? Or do you think it'll ever be, you know, do you think the truth will ever be readily available?
Well, I think one of the new ways they found to distort the present is cable news. And I'm, you know, news should have me throwing up some air quotes around it because
of course,
news, cable news entertainment. Now, obviously, there is news programs on cable in the United States. And I know there's, you know, CNN International and the BBC. But most people are learning about the world through pundits or personality shows, the O'Reilly Factor, Hardball with Chris Matthews, you know, that those are the most entertaining programs. So those have the, you know, the biggest audience draws, even though, I mean, Fox News does not a good job, but not a completely despicable job of actually presenting relevant news stories throughout the day.
They got badly wrong here recently.
there's an editorial slant behind the scenes, right? This is not going to show up, or this is how we're going to treat this story. But throughout most of the until it's prime time, there aren't a lot of people injecting huge amounts of opinion into the news narrative. But at 8 o'clock, when everyone's home and vegging out in front of the television, that's when they're not only giving you misrepresentation of what's going on, but they're also telling you how you should feel about it. Now you have, you know, liberal stations like MSNBC, you have conservative stations like Fox, you have CNN, which is God knows what, mixing all these people together and having these, you know, stupid debates. So I think 100 years from now, if people look back at this time, they would say, what the hell was the matter with these people? What were they thinking? How could they not have like some kind of clarity on even what was happening, you know? And I think it's the job of the alternative media to develop a more thoughtful and coherent narrative without all this professional wrestling presentation of the mainstream media. So in some ways, because there's so much more information, so much more contradictory information today that people will have to go through in the future, it might actually be more difficult. You know, I mean, I mentioned earlier in the show that historians do have procedures for reconciling contradictory sources. Was one person an eyewitness and the other person not an eyewitness? Was it firsthand, secondhand? Are they disagreeing on, you know, a particular specific point? And if that's the case, who would be the expert in that situation, giving the two people who are reporting? You know, like if we're talking about like the Old West, let's say, and there's a shooting or something, which was much more rare than I think a lot of people in America believe, just, you know, some gunfight or something. And there's the report filled out by the sheriff and the diary of some kind of bandit, you know, and they have contradictory sources. Well, the historian might say who has the authority in that situation, who has the clarity in their, you know, profession or in their emotion to represent the situation better, and they might go with the sheriff's account of it. So today, you just have, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's going to complicate historical procedures in the future to look at, you know, 100, you know, 200,000 different opinions about about something, and trying to reconcile that. So obviously, because you know, Kate mentioned technology, and that's important because there are actually visual records, right, of things happening. There are film. There's film of events that could be helpful. Another thing that could improve historical accuracy with filmmaking in the future is that films are getting so much easier to make. You can have a camera that will shoot a movie that is big picture cinema quality for $5,000-$6,000 now, and it will be less in the future. The kind of effects that you would need to save money on, you know, highly detailed period pieces. You know, you don't have to go to Egypt and build a set for Cleopatra anymore and spend, you know, $100 million, $200 million doing that and flying people to Egypt for first unit photography and all that. then maybe the kinds of meddlers who want to control the project, who want to micromanage the project and be like, let's maybe make up a love affair between this person and that person. It'll really sizzle on the screen. That kind of stuff. They're out of the game. There's no need for them anymore because they don't have to manage those huge amounts of money and screw up projects like they used to do in the past. So the filmmaking might have a better shot at telling more accurate stories because the centralization of power and control and decision making is eventually, hopefully, going to be out the window. So it's difficult to see what things would be like in maybe 50 years.
Yeah, it just, you know, it just makes me kind of angry sometimes when I think that in the future, the portrayal of 9/11, I think someone will make a film and it's like a love story and a girl meets a boy in an elevator and then 9/11 happens and they're going to totally just ruin it, you know.
Because they kind of poke fun at that in Futurama, because they're always getting like history, like totally our wrong. History badly wrong, because they think that like the honeymooners, when he says to the moon, Alice, they think that that was
that
the impetus
was the
to go to the moon
to
and
go
stuff.
To the moon. Like it's, they make jokes, like Matt Groening, the creator, you know, that there's some quite clever things actually that we saw in that. But it just it makes me angry to think that perhaps in the future, if people don't document and, you know, save their things, if people don't really take care of this information that we have, it could be banned. I mean,
but
people have to remember that. You
but
know,
then there might
to
be too many sources and people might argue over
much.
Who's telling the truth.
Well, that already happens. Have you been on the YouTube comments there, Dan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have too. And it's bad. Yeah,
it's pretty bad.
And I'm like, there's been so many times I've used this joke before on my show, but it's a video about, let's see, Glenn Greenwald. And 20 comments in, they're talking about some Jewish conspiracy, you know, and it's like, this is not constructive, I don't think. And obviously there's a lot of trolling. There's a lot of people looking for attention. There's a lot of people who only really feel efficacious by hurting other people on the internet, which is sad.
It's weird.
Yeah. So, you know, I have a friend who disables his YouTube comments.
I don't blame him.
Because that's not what it's about. You know, it's not about hearing this. I didn't put this video here for to see what 100 nitwits think of it, you know?
Quite right.
Yeah. So, as we begin to wrap up here, I was looking at a list that was like the top 10 most historically inaccurate films of all time. And funnily enough, Mel Gibson shows up again at number 6 on Apocalypto. So he's in it 3 times for Apocalypto of the Patriot.
But Mel Gibson was real, real lucky because when he wrote a film, when he did The Passion, he already had a script. He had the Bible. So
he
was real lucky there that he had that to go to.
But the number one in this list...
He really lucked out.
And I can't let this show go without saying this. The number one in this list of the 10 most historically accurate films... inaccurate films of all time, it's on killermovies.com, is 2001 A Space Odyssey. According to this film, in the year 2001, who would have had manned voyages to Jupiter, a battle of wits with a sentient computer, and a quantum leap in human evolution. Instead, we got the Mir space station falling from the sky, Windows XP, and Freddy got fingered. Apparently, the lesson here is that sometimes it's better when the movies get the facts all wrong.
Well, on that note,
on that note, Brett, thanks so much for coming on.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the School Sucks project and anything else you've got going on?
Yeah, sure. I encourage people to just go and check it out for themselves. It's schoolsucksproject.com. And you can, on the front page, you can see basically everything we've done recently. But there's also a drop down menu for a series. And, you know, we've covered everything from critical thinking to homeschooling to philosophical series. We have a series called School Sucks at the Movies, where we discuss films from a educational or philosophical angle. Mm-hmm. I would also encourage people to check us out on YouTube. The username is School Sucks Podcast. My most recent project was a creation of a video series based on John Taylor Gatto's book, The Underground History of American Education. And follow me on Twitter, which is at School Sucks Show. And if people want to converse with me or other people in the audience, we have a Facebook group and they can find it by just searching Facebook for School Sucks Project.
Excellent.
That's
my
awesome.
Pleasure.
That's awesome. So I will, of course, link all of those up at the bottom of the show. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Brett. We've had a great time.
Thank you for having me. I had a great time as well. This was really nice and relaxed. I really enjoyed it.
That's how we like to do it.
That's what we go for.
Absolutely.